Chapter 14. He turned back to the door, forcing an answer to her smile. "In the meanwhile, I shall have read it," he said. The door closed on him, and she hid her eyes from the dreadful emptiness of the room. The end. The House of the Dead Hand is first published in Atlantic Monthly, August 1904. Above all, the letter ended, "Don't leave Siena without seeing Dr. Lombard's Leonardo." Lombard is a queer old Englishman, a mystic or a madman if the two are not synonymous, and a devout student of the Italian Renaissance. He has lived for years in Italy, exploring its remotest corners, and has lately picked up an undoubted Leonardo, which came to light in a farmhouse near Bergamo. It is believed to be one of the missing pictures mentioned by Vasari, and is at any rate, according to the most competent authorities, a genuine and almost untouched example of the best period. Lombard is a queer stick, and jealous of showing his treasures. But we struck up a friendship when I was working on the Sodomas in Siena 3 years ago, and if you will give him the enclosed line you may get a peep at the Leonardo. Probably not more than a peep, though, for I hear he refuses to have it reproduced. I want badly to use it in my monograph on the Windsor drawings, so please see what you can do for me, and if you can't persuade him to let you take a photograph or make a sketch, at least jot down a detailed description of the picture, and get from him all the facts you can. I hear that the French and Italian governments have offered him a large advance on his purchase, but that he refuses to sell at any price, though he certainly can't afford such luxuries. In fact, I don't see where he got enough money to buy the picture. He lives in the Via Papagiulio. Wyant sat at the table d'hôte of his hotel, rereading his friend's letter over a late luncheon. He had been 5 days in Siena without having found time to call on Dr. Lombard, not from any indifference to the opportunity presented, but because it was his first visit to the strange red city, and he was still under the spell of its more conspicuous wonders, the brick palaces flinging out their wrought iron torch holders with a gesture of arrogant suzerainty, the great council chamber emblazoned with civic allegories, the pageant of Pope Julius on the library walls, the Sodoma smiling balefully through the dusk of moldering chapels, and it was only when his first hunger was appeased that he remembered that one course in the banquet was still untasted. He put the letter in his pocket, and turned to leave the room, with a nod to its only other occupant, an olive-skinned young man with lustrous eyes and a low collar, who sat on the other side of the table, perusing the Fanfula di Domenica. This gentleman, his daily vis a vis, returned the nod with a Latin eloquence of gesture, and Wyant passed on to the antechamber, where he paused to light a cigarette. He was just restoring the case to his pocket when he heard a hurried step behind him, and the lustrous eyed young man advanced through the glass doors of the dining room. "Pardon me, sir," he said in measured English, and with an intonation of exquisite politeness, "you have let this letter fall." Wyant, recognizing his friend's note of introduction to Dr. Lombard, took it with a word of thanks, and was about to turn away when he perceived that the eyes of his fellow diner remained fixed on him with a gaze of melancholy interrogation. "Again pardon me," the young man at length ventured, "but are you by chance the friend of the illustrious Dr. Lombard?" "No," returned Wyant, with the instinct of Anglo-Saxon distrust of foreign advances. Then, fearing to appear rude, he said with a guarded politeness, "perhaps, by the way, you can tell me the number of his house. I see it is not given here." The young man brightened perceptibly. "The number of the house is 13, but anyone can indicate it to you. It is well known in Siena. It is called," he continued after a moment, "the House of the Dead Hand." Wyant stared. "Had a queer name," he said. "The name comes from an antique hand of marble which for many hundred years has been above the door." Wyant was turning away with a gesture of thanks, when the other added, "if you would have the kindness to ring twice." "To ring twice?" "At the doctor's." The young man smiled. "Tea is the custom. It was a dazzling March afternoon, with a shower of sun from the mid-blue, and a marshalling of slaty clouds behind the umber-colored hills. For nearly an hour Wyatt loitered on the Lizza, watching the shadows race across the naked landscape, and the thunder blacken in the west. Then he decided to set out for the House of the Dead Hand. The map in his guidebook showed him that the Via Papagiulio was one of the streets which radiate from the piazza, and thither he bent his course, pausing at every other step, to fill his eye with some fresh image of weather-beaten beauty. The clouds had rolled upward, obscuring the sunshine and hanging like a funereal baldachin above the projecting cornices of Dr. Lombard Street, and Wyatt walked for some distance in the shade of the beetling palace fronts before his eye fell on the doorway surmounted by a sallow marble hand. He stood for a moment staring up at the strange emblem. The H hand was a woman's a dead drooping hand, which hung there convulsed and helpless, as though it had been thrust forth in denunciation of some evil mystery within the house, and had sunk struggling into death. A girl who was drawing water from the well in the court said that the English doctor lived on the first floor, and Wyatt, passing through a glazed door, mounted the damp degrees of a vaulted stairway with a plaster Aesculapius smoldering in a niche on the landing. Facing the Aesculapius was another door, and as Wyatt put his hand on the bell rope he remembered his unknown friend's injunction, and rang twice. His ring was answered by a peasant woman with a low forehead and small close-set eyes, who, after a prolonged scrutiny of himself, his card, and his letter of introduction, left him standing in a high, cold antechamber floored with brick. He heard her wooden pattens click down an interminable corridor, and after some delay she returned and told him to follow her. They passed through a long saloon, bare as the antechamber, but loftily vaulted, and frescoed with a 17th century triumph of Scipio or Alexander Marshall figures following Wyatt with the film melancholy gaze of shades in limbo. At the end of this apartment he was admitted to a smaller room, with the same atmosphere of mortal cold, but showing more obvious signs of occupancy. The walls were covered with tapestry which had faded to the gray-brown tints of decaying vegetation, so that the young man felt as though he were entering a sunless autumn wood. Against these hangings stood a few tall cabinets on heavy gilt feet, and at a table in the window three persons were seated. An elderly lady who was warming her hands over a brazier, a girl bent above a strip of needlework, and an old man. As the latter advanced toward Wyatt, the young man was conscious of staring with unseemly intentness at his small round-backed figure, dressed with shabby disorder and surmounted by a wonderful head, lean, vulpine, eagle-beaked as that of some art-loving despot of the Renaissance. A head combining the venerable hair and large prominent eyes of the humanist with the greedy profile of the adventurer. Wyatt, in musing on the Italian portrait medals of the 15th century, had often fancied that only in that period of fierce individualism could types so paradoxical have been produced. Yet the subtle craftsman who committed them to the bronze had never drawn a face more strangely stamped with contradictory passions than that of Dr. Lombard. "I am glad to see you," he said to Wyatt, extending a hand which seemed a mere framework held together by knotted veins. "I lead a quiet life here and receive few visitors, but any friend of Professor Clyde's is welcome." Then, with a gesture which included the two women, he added dryly, "Colin, my wife and daughter often talk of Professor Clyde. Oh yes, he used to make me such nice toast." "They don't understand toast in Italy," said Mrs. Lombard in a high plaintive voice. It would have been difficult, from Dr. Lombard's manner and appearance, to guess his nationality. But his wife was so inconsciently and ineradicably English that even the silhouette of her cap seemed a protest against continental laxities. She was a stout, fair woman, with pale cheeks netted with red lines. A brooch with a miniature portrait sustained a Bogwood watch chain upon her bosom, and at her elbow lay a heap of knitting and an old copy of The Queen. The young girl, who had remained standing, was a slim replica of her mother, with an apple-cheeked face and opaque blue eyes. Her small head was prodigally laden with braids of dull fair hair, and she might have had a kind of transient prettiness, but for the sullen droop of her round mouth. It was hard to say whether her expression implied ill temper or apathy, but Wyant was struck by the contrast between the fierce vitality of the doctor's age and the inanimateness of his daughter's youth. Seating himself in the chair which his host advanced, the young man tried to open the conversation by addressing to Mrs. Lombard some random remark on the beauties of Siena. The lady murmured a resigned assent, and Dr. Lombard interposed with a smile, "My dear sir, my wife considers Siena a most salubrious spot, and is favorably impressed by the cheapness of the marketing. But she deplores the total absence of muffins and cannel coal, and cannot resign herself to the Italian method of dusting furniture." "But they don't, you know they don't dust it," Mrs. Lombard protested, without showing any resentment of her husband's manner. "Precisely, they don't dust it. Since we have lived in Siena, we have not once seen the cobwebs removed from the battlements of the mangia. Can you conceive of such housekeeping? My wife has never yet dared to write it home to her aunts at Bonchurch." Mrs. Lombard accepted in silence this remarkable statement of her views, and her husband, with a malicious smile at Wyant's embarrassment, planted himself suddenly before the young man. "And now," said he, "do you want to see my Leonardo?" "Do I?" cried Wyant, on his feet in a flash. The doctor chuckled. "H," he said, with a kind of crooning deliberation, "that's the way they all behave, that's what they all come for." He turned to his daughter with another variation of mockery in his smile. "Aunt Fancy, it's for your beaux, my dear, or for the mature charms of Mrs. Lombard," he added, glaring suddenly at his wife, who had taken up her knitting and was softly murmuring over the number of her stitches. Neither lady appeared to notice his pleasantries, and he continued, addressing himself to Wyant, they all come, but many are called, and few are chosen." His voice sank to solemnity. "While I live," he said, "no unworthy I shall desecrate that picture. But I will not do my friend Clyde the injustice to suppose that he would send an unworthy representative. He tells me he wishes a description of the picture for his book, and you shall describe it to him if you can." Wyant hesitated, not knowing whether it was a propitious moment to put in his appeal for a photograph. "Well, sir," he said, "you know Clyde wants me to take away all I can of it." Dr. Lombard eyed him sardonically. "You're welcome to take away all you can carry," he replied, adding, as he turned to his daughter, "that is, if he has your permission, Sibylla." The girl rose without a word, and laying aside her work, took a key from a secret drawer in one of the cabinets, while the doctor continued in the same note of grim jocularity, "for you must know that the picture is not mine, it is my daughter's." He followed with evident amusement the surprised glance which Wyant turned on the young girl's impassive figure. "Sibylla," he pursued, "is a votary of the arts, as he has inherited her fond father's passion for the unattainable. Luckily, however, she also recently inherited a tidy legacy from her grandmother, and having seen the Leonardo, on which its discoverer had placed a price far beyond my reach, she took a step which deserves to go down to history. She invested her whole inheritance in the purchase of the picture, thus enabling me to spend my closing years in communion with one of the world's masterpieces. My dear sir, could Antigone do more?" The object of this strange eulogy had meanwhile drawn aside one of the tapestry hangings and fitted her key into a concealed door. "Come," said Dr. Lombard, "let us go before the light fails us." Wyant glanced at Mrs. Lombard, who continued to knit impassively. "No, no," said his host, "my wife will not come with us. You might not suspect it from her conversation, but my wife has no feeling for art, Italian art, that is, for no one is fonder of our early Victorian school." "Frith's railway station, you know," said Mrs. Lombard, smiling. "I like an animated picture." Miss Lombard, who had unlocked the door, held back the tapestry to let her father and Wyatt pass out. Then she followed them down a narrow stone passage with another door at its end. This door was iron-barred, and Wyatt noticed that it had a complicated patent lock. The girl fitted another key into the lock, and Dr. Lombard led the way into a small room. The dark paneling of this apartment was irradiated by streams of yellow light slanting through the disbanded thunder clouds, and in the central brightness hung a picture concealed by a curtain of faded velvet. "A little too bright, Sibylla," said Dr. Lombard. His face had grown solemn, and his mouth twitched nervously as his daughter drew a linen drapery across the upper part of the window. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.